This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, a jury in Philadelphia, Mississippi, convicted 80-year-old Edgar Ray Killen on 3 counts of manslaughter in the 1964 murders of 3 civil rights workers. Exactly 41 years ago today, Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Cheney disappeared on a remote back road in rural Neshoba County. 6 weeks later, an anonymous tip led the FBI to their bodies buried in an earthen dam. A later federal trial told the horrific story of that day, how the Ku Klux Klan lured the 3 young men into the county by burning a black church, then pursued their car when they tried to flee, then how they beat and shot them. In that trial, an all-white jury convicted 7 Klansmen on civil rights charges, but deadlocked on Killen because one juror said she could not convict a preacher. At the time, murders galvanized the civil rights movement and have since stood as a monument to the brutality and injustice of the era. 4 decades later, the final act was staged in a quiet courtroom where the wheelchair-bound defendant appeared to doze through closing arguments. A cordon of police stood watch outside the courtroom as the verdict was read. There was no visible reaction from Killen. Today we look at what this conviction means for Mississippi, for the South, and for the country. Later in the hour, we'll focus on the state of California, where the blockbuster governor is at risk of seeing his stardom fade. But first, today's verdict in Mississippi. If you have questions about this case and its conclusion, if you were there during Freedom Summer, join the conversation. If you think that perhaps this trial was not appropriate to hold after all this time, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our first guest is Manuel Roy Franzia. He's the Miami Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. He's been covering this story for the newspaper, and he joins us now from the courthouse in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Good of you to join us today.
Good afternoon.
What was the reaction in the courtroom when the verdict came out?
Well, it was a repressed reaction because the judge had warned the audience quite sternly to not show their emotions. But as I was looking around the courtroom, I saw people cupping their hands over their mouths to hold back the gasps. I saw people tearing up. Beginning to sob. This was a long time in coming for many of the people in that courtroom, and the emotion of it was palpable, even though it was almost utterly silent.
As I mentioned, the AP Wire version accounts said little reaction from the defendant.
Yes, I was watching his face. He clenched his jaw several times. That was noticeable, something we hadn't seen before. And then moments after the verdict had been read, his wife came over and draped herself over his shoulders, and he lifted up his left hand. You imagine he is in a wheelchair because of a wood-cutting accident, and he cupped his hand over the side of her head.
Was he immediately taken away into custody?
It was interesting, Neil. Edgar Ray Killen had been accused for many years of co-opting law enforcement in Philadelphia, Mississippi. That was the great, dark, horrible aspect of this case, that it was law enforcement that worked with him to kill these men. After this verdict was read, he was taken out of the courtroom by deputies for the Neshoba County Sheriff's Department, the same sheriff's department that he was accused of corrupting.
When is he likely to be sentenced?
A sentencing date is going to be set today. He faces up to 20 years on each of 3 separate manslaughter charges, one for each of the civil rights workers whose names are absolutely synonymous with the civil rights era, Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. He will face at least a minimum of 1 year on each of those counts, according to Jim Hood, who's the state attorney general in Mississippi and also personally tried this case.
Now, the jury started its deliberations yesterday. At the end of the day yesterday, we were told there was a 6-6 deadlock. Is there any idea what unlocked it?
We haven't gotten any insights from this jury. This is a jury that was kept under wraps. It was sequestered. And they were filed out of the courtroom and have not been heard from since. But this jury moved quickly once it got back today. Overall, only about 5 five and a half hours of deliberation. And they moved from a 6-6 split to this verdict on manslaughter. And some have even begun to wonder whether the split, 6-6, was not a split for guilty versus not guilty, but a split between manslaughter and the charges that prosecutors truly hoped that Edgar Ray Killen would be convicted of, which was murder.
And he was found innocent on murder charges, or not guilty.
The jury made no statement as relates to those charges. They simply took the option of manslaughter and didn't address the question of murder. Although I will tell you that afterwards, Rita Bender, who was the wife of Michael Schwerner, really the leader of this trio who was killed, the man that the Klan was targeting on that night, he had a goatee and they called him Goat in their secret meetings. Rita Bender testified during this trial, and afterwards, while she characterized today as a historic and significant and important day, she did lament the fact that the people on the jury did not designate this as murder. It was more than a legal question for her and for many others here. It was a symbolic one.
Were there any other family members of the men who were killed all those years ago, or were there members of Mr. Killen's family as well?
Yes. During this trial, and it really moved much more quickly than anyone had anticipated. On most days, there were very few supporters for Edgar Ray Killen. Yesterday, during closing arguments, a rather large contingent came, up filling about three rows, people from the public, and also Edgar Ray Killen's wife, his brother, and a stepson. Today, his wife was there, as she has been each of the days, and so was his brother, but that larger group of supporters were nowhere to be seen. On the other side of the courtroom, in the front row, you had a panorama of grief. Rita Bender, the graceful, well-spoken wife of Michael Schwerner, who had brought tears to the eyes of many in the courtroom during her testimony. You had Ben Chaney, who is the brother of James Chaney. If you remember, James Chaney was the one black member of this three-person group. And Ben Chaney is still filled with a sense of rage about what has happened in the time that has passed since these killings. And he and others have made the point that if there had not been two white men who were killed on that day, that it is very likely that the death of his brother, James Chaney, would have been ignored by Mississippi, ignored by the federal government, and, talking directly to the people who he is accusing, ignored by the media.
We're speaking with Manuel Roig Franzia, the Miami, Miami Bureau Chief of the Washington Post, for covering the Killen trial in Philadelphia, Mississippi. If you're joining us late, three manslaughter guilty verdicts were handed down today. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Susan joins us now. She's calling from Asheville, North Carolina.
Yes, I'm actually in my car, but I hope you can hear me. I was one of Andy Goodman's schoolmates at Queens College in New York City in the 60s. I also was a family acquaintance of Mickey Schwerner because his parents were my aunt and uncle's very good friends. And I want to say that this is 41 years that these two men, as well as James Chaney, have been denied life. And whatever can be done to Mr. Killen at this point is probably past due and too little too late, but it's still a victory for justice, and I was thrilled to hear the outcome of this trial.
Susan, thanks very much for taking the time to call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Manuela Roig-Franzia, you described in a story before the verdict came in, obviously, you described Killen as one of the graying men in handcuffs and prison jumpsuits, unrepentant of their pasts, even as their limbs stiffened with age. Given the time difference that Susan and so many others have commented on, might this be the last trial of its sort?
There are a lot of people in the South who have been pushing for these old cases to be opened up, who placed a great importance on this case because it is the case that represented an opportunity to get at the very heart of a crime, to the mastermind of a crime that riveted the nation during the civil rights movement. But some of these other cases are much, much more difficult to pursue than this case was. And granted, this was a difficult case. A case in point is Emmett Till, the young man who was killed in Money, Mississippi, because he had allegedly whistled at a white woman. We all saw his casket being exhumed in the Chicago area not long ago. But that case is so hard because the two men who confessed to killing Emmett Till confessed in a magazine article after being acquitted in that killing are dead. So many witnesses are dead. So many conspirators are dead that it leaves prosecutors with an almost impossible task. They need to recreate history, and they also have to find tangential players in some respects. And prosecutors don't like to lose cases, even the most dogged ones. And they face a very difficult challenge in the Emmett Till case. That's not to say that they cannot bring charges and get convictions. And in several other cases that we know less about, a perfect example is in Florida in the early 1950s. One of the early civil rights activists, a man named Harry Moore, was killed when a bomb was blown up under his house the day before Christmas, on Christmas Eve. He's someone who's been lost to time, and many of the people who are involved in that crime or were involved in that crime have been lost to time, too.
Manuel Roig-Franzia, thank you very much for being with us from Philadelphia, Mississippi. More on this case after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, 41 years after the brutal killings of three civil rights workers in Neshoba County, Mississippi, a jury convicted 80-year-old Edgar Ray Killen of their murders. Manslaughter, three counts. This hour, we'll be discussing what this new conviction and this old crime mean for the South and for the country. We want to hear from you. Does this prosecution change anything for you? Are these crimes that should be reopened or left alone? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Dick Mulpas, a former Secretary of State of Mississippi, now president of the Mulpas Woodlands Group. He ran for governor of Mississippi in 1995, but lost, some say, because he apologized to the families of James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner. He joined us now on the phone from his office in Jackson, Mississippi. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You grew up in and around Philadelphia, Mississippi. You may have known some of these people.
Oh, of course. I grew up my entire life in Philadelphia. I was 14, the summer of 1964, out of the 19 men who were indicted originally with the federal charges back in 1967. I knew 12 of those just from seeing them around in the community. So yes, I had a front row seat to everything that that happened in 1964. A good portion of it.
Remind us what those days were like.
Well, those were a pretty terrifying period. It was the community was ruled by fear. The sheriff and the deputy sheriff of the Shelby County were in the Klan. The deputy sheriff subsequently indicted and went to prison for murdering, being a part of the murders of Mr. Cheney, Swerner, and Goodman. There were churches burned. There were beatings, crosses burned all over the county, and it was just a lawless time to grow up in and to literally have a front row seat to see something that changed the future of this country.
Over over all of those long years, and not just in this case, but in some of the other cases, the Medgar Evers case and the Birmingham Church case, people with troubled consciences emerged after all of that time with important evidence. In this case, it was a man named Cecil Price, a former sheriff's deputy, who investigators long believed used his badge and his position to trap these three men all that time ago.
That's correct.
And what is it, do you think, after all these years, did they change their minds? Was it just a guilty conscience?
Well, what you've seen is a new generation of leadership develop, particularly in the state that I'm from, and we've seen the murders of Vernon Dahmer and Medgar Evers, both arrested and convicted, and now we've seen the ringleader of the murders of Mr. Cheney Swarner and Goodman convicted. You're seeing for example, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, a year ago, a group called the Philadelphia Coalition came together, multiracial group, Choctaw Indian, African Americans, whites, and they began pushing for justice in this case, and it was a perfect example of leadership. We saw the community move behind them, the Board of Supervisors, the local, the mayor and the city alderman. 1,500 people came a year ago to a commemoration, and that led us to what we've seen today. And you neglected to mention this. This is the 41st anniversary today of the deaths of Mr. Cheney, Swarner, and Goodman. So it's a supreme irony that there's justice here finally after 41 long years.
Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Paul. Paul's calling us from Stonington, Connecticut.
Yes, hello. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
My point, and as you said, to keep it brief, is that I did not agree that this should have gone to trial. And my problem is that the prosecutors have the discretion to bring the case or not to bring the case. And they will only bring cases where the witnesses favorable to the prosecution are still living and the prosecution can make their case. And unfortunately, defendants do not have that right. And I feel that you're going to get a disproportionate amount of cases where the facts 40 years later are more favorable to the prosecution than if the trial were contemporaneous with the incident. And that's my only comment.
Dick Mulpas, I think it was Mr. Killen's lawyer, said justice delayed is justice denied. It's been 40 years.
Well, it has, but there's a good reason that there's no statute of limitations on murder. There is on lesser crimes, but there's just simply not on murder, and it never should be. Mr. Killen received a fair trial. There were prosecution witnesses just as there were defense witnesses. So everyone started out with the same handicap. It was 41 years later, but the evidence was overwhelming that Mr. Killen was the ringleader of these murderers. And so here we see, 41 years later, some measure of justice to Mr. Killen.
Go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, but I think what you're going to find, sir, is that disproportionate number of trials, when they do come to trial 40 years later or whatever the number of years is later, are going to be cases where the prosecution has an easier time because certain prosecutorial witnesses are still alive and are competent, and certain defense witnesses have either passed away or are no longer competent. And that's my only point. I just don't think it's fair. 40 years is an awfully long period of time.
Well, just a thought from this end. None of us live in a perfect world, nor do we have a perfect judicial system. But Mr. Killen's rights were protected. The jurors heard both sides of this, and I think that's all we can do 41 years later. Just because it was not brought in the past as it should have been, in my opinion, there's no reason not to deal with it now.
Paul, thanks very much for the phone call.
Have a good day.
Dick Mulpas, in 1989, on this very day, you spoke at the Ecumenical Memorial Service at Mount Zion Church. Last of all, you said, my heart is full today because I know that if James Cheney, Andy Goodman, and Mickey Schwerner were to return today, they would see a Philadelphia and a Mississippi that, far from perfect, are closer to being the kind of place that God wants us to be. They would find, perhaps to their surprise, that our trials and difficulties have given Mississippi a special understanding of the need for redemption and reconciliation and have empowered us to serve as a beacon for the nation. What kind of Philadelphia do you think they would find today if they returned?
Well, those words were hopeful in 1989. I think that Neshoba County, Philadelphia, my hometown, and Mississippi lived into those words today. I think there's a recognition that first and foremost, despite the political significance of this, the significance in the civil rights movement, that what happened in my hometown was a human tragedy. And so all of us who've been involved in pushing for justice for a number of years hope first and foremost that this verdict is going to bring some comfort and peace to the families of Mr. Cheney, Swerner, and Goodman.
Mr. Malpas, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dick Malpas, former Secretary of State of Mississippi and now president of the Malpas Woodlands Group, and he joined us on the phone from his office in Jackson, Mississippi. Joining us now from Learned, Mississippi, is Richard Barrett, founder and general counsel for the Nationalist Movement. Good to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Neil. I'm not the founder, but I appreciate the compliment.
All right, then. I apologize for the error. What's your response to today's verdict in Philadelphia?
Well, I certainly wouldn't hope that the Black Caucus would be gloating too much, because remember, Mississippi voted 466,000 people for the Confederate flag, and we also had a Reconstruction one time before, if you remember, when the state was completely under a Black Caucus. The whites were disenfranchised, and it was the kind of a society that Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney wanted. We had that, but we overthrew it then, and we'll overthrow it again.
Overthrow it again. It sounds as if you're, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but unrepentant.
Well, unreconstructed, we tend to say down here. You know, this is a show trial that we've seen. It follows exactly the Beria purges, you know, of the Stalinist era. We didn't celebrate those kind of persecutions, like here, where they don't have witnesses. They just bring up ancient documents. I'm a lawyer, and I've always thought you're supposed to be able to look a witness in the eye. They tried when Mrs. Schwerner Bender was testifying. The witness wasn't even present. They were trying him in absentia. The Seventh Amendment says you cannot re-examine the facts tried in a case previously in any court in the United States. I honestly think that Americans are perhaps saying, maybe like Mississippians are today, you may stomp on our red clay, you may trample on our red necks, but you can't tread upon our rights.
I understand that Mr. Killen had initially asked you to be his defense attorney.
He did indeed, Neil, and I turned it down for one reason, and that is the man is not competent. I couldn't represent him because I couldn't converse with him. And you notice that the United States Supreme Court yesterday, ironically, ruled that a lawyer has a duty to have a mental examination for a client that has a disability, a mental disability. Too bad that ruling didn't come down a little earlier, because the man never should have been put on trial in the first place.
Well, it may be a source for an appeal, but...
See, that's the point. No, there's not going to be an appeal. I mean, it's not going to be successful because there's so much, you know, the man is so old. But you notice that Mr. Malpas said something about there's no statute of limitations on murder?
Correct.
You see, he forgets that there's a Constitution, which is not... A statute, it's higher than a statute. A statute says, you know, you can't have chickens in your yard. The Constitution, the Sixth Amendment, says you have a right to a speedy trial. That surmounts a statute.
Richard Barrett, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate
your
time today. Richard Barrett is of the National Movement. Join us from Learned, Mississippi. And with us now is Robert Moses, a former field secretary in Mississippi for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. He joins us from Lanier High School in Jackson, Mississippi. Nice of you to join us today.
All right. Thanks.
Listening to our previous conversation, obviously you've been involved in civil rights issues in the South and in Mississippi for quite a long time, and there's work to do.
Yeah. Actually, it's work for the country. It's Neil, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And it's interesting, Attorney Barrett mentioned the Constitution, because Mississippi's Constitution actually is the Constitution of 1890. It was the Constitutional Convention that was called in Mississippi to make sure that the freed slaves did not participate in the politics of Mississippi. And it still is the state's constitution. It doesn't give anybody, talking about trampling on their rights, but actually nobody in Mississippi, according to its constitution, has the right to vote or the right to a public school education because they didn't want to say anything about that in 1890, right? So, but the deeper picture really is the picture that Attorney Barrett painted about our country and Americans, and exactly whether the country wants to follow Mississippi, that's a real question in my mind. Whether, why is it that our country really wants to follow the lead of Mississippi?
Well, perhaps his vision of Mississippi, anyway.
So, and I think if you look at the actual historical context, which preceded the coming of the volunteers into Mississippi, there were three murders that kind of were benchmarks leading to the coming of the volunteers. There was Herbert Lee, who was murdered by Eugene Hurst in August of 1961. Herbert Lee was a black farmer in Amick County. And Eugene Hurst was a member of the Mississippi State Legislature. And Herbert Lee used to drive Steptoe and myself around. Steptoe was the head of the Amick County NAACP. And Eugene Hurst just gunned him down at the cotton gin there in Liberty in Amick County. And all we could do in response to that murder was to commit ourselves personally to the work. The few SNCC field secretaries who were had begun doing voter registration in Mississippi. Then you remember in June of 1963, Medgar Evers was murdered. And Medgar's murder attracted national attention, and it attracted two people who turned out to be key to the movement here in Mississippi and the country. One was Bob Spike, who was the director of the National Council of Churches. And he came south in response to Medgar's murder and set up shop in Mississippi. And the other was Albert Lowenstein.
From New York.
From New York.
We're talking with Robert Moses, a former field secretary for SNCC. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Al came in and... in the fall of 1963, he got students from Stanford and Yale to come down to volunteer with the SNCC and Corps field secretaries in a vote that we were putting on. We were running Aaron Henry, who was the head of the State Conference of Branches of the NAACP, and Ed King, who was white and the chaplain at Tougaloo for governor and lieutenant governor in the fall of 1963 on a kind of mock election.
Right.
And so that allowed us to take a look at how the country would pay attention to students coming in to work in Mississippi in ways that they hadn't quite been able to pay attention to the SNCC workers. So in the winter of 1963, thanks to Bob Spike, we were in Hattiesburg, and the Justice Department had a suit against the registrar in Hattiesburg. And Bob Spike was bringing in ministers from the Midwest to come down and walk on the picket line and protest. And in the meantime, we had started a discussion within SNCC and CORE about having a summer project and bringing in large numbers of students from around the country. And in the middle of that campaign in Hattiesburg, Lewis Allen was murdered in Amick County. And Lewis Allen was the only person who had come forward to testify at Herbert Lee's murder. And so we went over to investigate that murder, and it was Lewis Allen's murder that really turned the tide in terms of the internal debate about whether we should have this summer project or not. And so those three murders, the Herbert Lee, Medgar Evers, and Lewis Allen, sort of were setting the stage for what happened in 64 when Mickey, James, and Andy were murdered. And the point is that the country was able to respond to Mickey and James and Andy because it involved a white northern students, and there were a whole lot of white northern students involved. It doesn't know the names of Herbert Lee and Lewis Allen.
Can you stay with us over the break?
Yeah.
We'll take a call with you after the break on the verdict today. Guilty on 3 counts of manslaughter in Philadelphia, Mississippi. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're wrapping up our discussion of the verdict in Philadelphia, Mississippi today, where a former Ku Klux Klan leader was convicted on 3 counts of manslaughter in the deaths of civil rights workers in 1964. Our guest is Robert Moses, who served during the 1960s as a field secretary in Mississippi for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He's with us by phone from Lanier High School in Jackson, Mississippi. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Tony. Tony's calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yes. I'm thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And when I listened to the subject matter, I recall that time when those bodies were discovered. My parents had taken our family to New York to the New York World's Fair. And it came over the radio that the bodies had been found. And I remember how frightened my parents were and how they made us as children lay on the floor in the hotel room because they were afraid that just riots and everything else was going to break out. I can't remember them being so frightened before then. So for those who say that it's just been so long and people should forget about it, I just think that this was the stuff of nightmares for a lot of children in my generation back then, and that I'm just happy that it was pursued.
So it is important for you, justice long delayed but finally delivered?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a nightmare that I had. Many nights I struggled with this when I was a child and growing up, because one of the things they said to us was, we almost understood it as African-Americans if there were African-Americans down there doing this. But these were people that weren't African-Americans. There was one African-American, and they still did this to them. So it just made it all the more frightening.
Robert Moses, let me ask you, I know you were talking about other cases that have not been taken up and murders yet unsolved. Is this verdict important?
Yes, absolutely. There's no question of its importance. It would really be very important if it allows the country to probe its memories, right? Like the woman was just doing about her own personal memories, but the country needs to probe its public memories, its historical memories. It needs to understand that Mississippi is really telling the country something about itself, and that's what's difficult. The country wants to look at Mississippi and learn something about Mississippi. It's difficult for the country to look at Mississippi and these murders and learn something about itself.
Robert Moses, thank you very much. Appreciate your time today. Robert Moses, joined us by phone from Lanier High School in Jackson, Mississippi, taking time out on a road trip to stop by and talk with us. He used to be field secretary in Mississippi for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Tony, thank you very much for the phone call. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the political difficulties of the governor of California.